This is Catherine Hastings. My guest today is Keith Ratzliff, author of 4 collections of poetry, including his latest, Then a Thousand Crows, published by Anhinga Press. Ratzliff has won a Theodore Rettke Award as well as a Pushcart Prize and teaches writing and literature as a professor of English at Central College in Pella, Iowa. Welcome, Keith.
Thanks, Catherine.
Very nice to have you here. You're a long way from home. What brings you to California?
I've got some family in Fresno and in Reedley, but I'm doing some readings from the book around the Central Valley and Northern California.
Well, your book, Then a Thousand Crows, is not your first book published by Anhinga. A previous collection, Man Under a Pear Tree, won the 1996 Anhinga Prize for Poetry.
Right.
That's
right.
Great. So, although I have not seen that particular book, I have to assume that Man Under a Pear Tree is an ekphrastic poem referring to the work by Paul Klee.
Right,
is that
Paul
correct?
Klee, right. And
yes, Klee, sorry.
Yeah, I that was my first sort of doodling with Paul Klee. I spent a fair amount of a couple of years putting a Paul Klee image on my desk when I started writing in the morning, just because it was one of those things, one of those little crutches that we all use. And I started to what I think was write with him, not so much ekphrastically, but as a kind of parallel. At least I hope that's what they are. And yeah, Man Under a Pear Tree was the first of that. And then Dubious Angels, which came after that, was devoted exclusively to images by Paul Klee.
Right. The full title of the book is Dubious Angels, Poems After Paul Klee.
Right, right.
So what is it about him in particular that that inspires you to write poetry? Is it his own, you know, his mood, his beliefs? What is it?
When I first ran into Paul Klee, I was living in London. And for about a year, I was a young Midwestern poet. And my voice, my literal speaking voice, was absolutely out of place in London. People would would sort of good-naturedly point fun at the way I said the word tomato.
Oh, instead of tomato.
Instead of tomato. And I literally was handcuffed for a while because my voice, and by extension, my poetic voice, simply didn't work in that situation. I was a pretty good little Midwestern poet up to that point, and I stopped writing. I didn't know what to do. And I walked into the Tate Gallery, and there was this exhibition by Paul Klee, and it was like a little dam burst. And I sat down, and I just started doodling, and I was pretty sure that no one but me would ever see them, was pretty sure that no one would ever care. But I was having so much fun because Paul Klee has fun. They have a sense of humor.
Yes, there's a real childlike quality
exactly.
to a lot of his work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that was the opening, that instead of that kind of Midwestern sincerity, there was a sense that maybe I could use my sense of humor. I have one, contrary to what my students might say, but a sense of irony, a sense of play, a sense of looseness that didn't have to pick up every possible thread and weave it in. But mostly it was because the paintings looked like they were having so much fun, and I wanted to have fun too, so I just started doodling off of them.
I think that's great.
Though that book in particular, there are 50 angels that Paul Klee did toward the end of his life. He was dying of scleroderma, which must have been excruciatingly painful. And Klee was a prodigious worker, sometimes hundreds of images a year. And he almost stopped. And then in the 2 years, and he obviously knew he was dying, this great burst of creativity. And then inside all of that, there are 50 little angels, which are not your coffee table book angels, ugly and scatological and funny and heartbreaking. And I tried to do what I could to give those angels some voices.
Well, the opening poems in Then a Thousand Crows appears to draw from your own experiences growing up in a small town. Where did you grow up? In Iowa?
No, I grew up in a little town in the middle of Nebraska, which might be worse. a town of under 1,000 people called Henderson, Right on Interstate 80.
Can't say I've been there.
if you've been across the country on Interstate 80,
I've been to Hastings, Nebraska.
You've been very close to my house then.
Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead and read the first poem of the book, Big Circus.
The Big Circus. The only circus ever in my small town pitched its tent in our one park beside the tennis court, beside the top of the slide my brother fell from that day. He'd run away from home, to the park, to the slide that was as much circus as he could imagine in a small town, our faces written in the dirt, generation after one after another. He took a girl with him, on the lam. He was 5. Later that summer, they would climb the stepladder, fold out the little platform that said, "This is not a step," and kill a newborn kitten. That little tightrope walker working without a rope, by lifting it there, over and over, the cat head first, off and off until you know already, the big top. He was gone so early. But the circus. We were all umbrellas, twirling into the tent, which was breathing its way open and up, and then flags. One flag, really. And my brother, later that summer, dropping matches in the fuel oil tank. We were so lucky. I won a black glass hand in the shape of an ashtray. He couldn't read the warning. It only seemed our houses were in flames. The circus was one wagon, one tent, one bear, nothing high enough to fall from. And he bit his tongue nearly through for all it taught him. It was an omen that told our fortunes. "This is not a step," the step said. And we were all still alive then, but planning how not to be.
There are a lot of disturbing images in this poem. In fact, your brother seems like he is somewhat disturbed. forgive me for saying no. Is this a true story poem? Did he kill a kitten? Did he drop a match in a fuel tank?
He did. He did all of these things. And he was both pleased that he was the first character in the book. But also, he would argue with me that these things were not quite that bad. But I saw him do this. He and this little friend of his, and I had one of those moments, and I must have been 10, and it was one of those moments when you really realized there were terrible things happening in the world, things you couldn't protect even from the most innocent people like my little brother who didn't know what he was
doing.
Children
can be cruel.
He did not know.
Yeah.
And we found out that there's no way he could have ignited the fuel oil in that tank. One little match wouldn't have done that.
I wondered, because of that line about the glass black hand, if something really did happen from that match.
No, nothing.
These are the things this poem makes us think about. Okay. Well, a little further on in the book, there's a poem that focuses on another brother, Pursuit. And in his actions, you ask us to visualize him as almost being archaic, almost like a Neanderthal. You say the action of the poem takes place before Hammurabi, before Shamash.
Yeah. This is a poem that actually owes a little bit to a Paul Klee image of someone chasing someone else and with a sort of yellow spear. And my brother Randy, who sells irrigation equipment, he was going to Africa to work on an irrigation deal. And when I read the poem, you'll hear this. He got caught in some sort of scam, as a Nebraska boy might, I suppose, where someone said, "Oh no, your hotel is full. I'll take you to another one."
Oh no.
And he very nearly got mugged. Luckily, he got out of that. But that the image here is of such basic sorts of, this is a very old story, someone taking advantage of someone who doesn't know what's going on. And I placed it back before Hammurabi and the oldest laws. But also I imagined actually someone, maybe even Paul Klee, doing this Neanderthal sort of drawing of that kind of picture. Pursuit. But this is the story of my other brother, running in New York without his dog or anyone's dog, running down the motel corridor, miles from the airport, alone except for the two men chasing him. It's a story old as legs, as two against one, as shapes on a cave wall. Imagine my brother as a stick man, his gimpy knee a broken line, in his stick chest a little cloud, his head red with running and panic. On his shoulder, a yellow aura that is his watcher, his spirit expecting the worst, preparing to leave his body as fire. And here's the taxi driver in his yellow stick cab who told my brother he knew a good cheap motel, but who also knew the setup, knew the two-stick thugs in Nikes. This is before writing and police, before Hammurabi and Shamesh and the law, before the gun one of them surely has, before bullet and crossbow and razor below the ear, before bait and switch, before small-town boy goes to the city to run as if he were a burning building, which he is, which we all are. And imagine an artist in a cave blowing vermilion powder over the whole scene because he can't keep up. He's Paleolithic, for God's sake, beating a rock with a rock, trying to stop everything from going up in flames. And in the real New York, a miracle. My brother's room key works on the first try. And without any help from anyone, without the comfort of art, he slams the door and saves himself. You probably thought there was a stick spear coming. Dead bison and dead stick aurochs, the spirit hunted down like a replacement dog. Stick weeping, stick tears. Even if poetry saves nothing, who wouldn't stop the two men, or stop anything from happening, in New York then, or New York later, or Dubai, or Dar es Salaam? Who wouldn't save his brother in a poem if he could? So imagine I've also saved his daughter, my niece, dying last week in childbirth, eclampsia, that old story, by inventing EMTs and plasma and the life flight to Denver. Imagine her spirit bird crowing stick notes that looked like alarm, then weren't. Imagine many ochre arrows of praise. I've told my students for a number of years that I don't write about my family, just because it's more trouble than it's worth, and I encourage them not to write about their families as well. These poems have found their way in, and I'm telling basically those family stories that people tell around the Thanksgiving dinner table,
right,
or things
over
like
and
that.
Over, because they're good stories.
Because they're good stories. Yeah. Most of them end happily, or at least perhaps more happily than they do here. My brothers are all wonderful men.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And not
everybody's fine.
Everybody's fine out there.
Okay, well, let's talk about your father for a minute.
Well, let's
your father appears in a poem called Flood, and this is by no means a happy poem, but the imagery used to depict a stroke is really very, very lovely.
Thank you. Thank you. The one thing you might want to know about Flood is there are two references to Leonardo da Vinci, and that one of them is a red pencil drawing of Leda, just her head and these braids that she's got, almost they seemed almost Dutch to me, wound around her head, or Danish or something like that, and the energy that's in the curves of that hair. And what you find out is that Leonardo found that same kind of energy in the way water moved, in the way the blood moved when he did autopsies, all of this kind of curling and swirling kinds of things that show up in Leda's hair, show up in his drawings of the heart as well, which is sort of one of the places here. The other thing, there's a blue jay in the poem, and my father was a kind of a squawker, I suppose, and a tough guy, and someone who was fearless, and blue jays have always reminded me of my father. So blue jays are in the poem as well. Flood. Morning of new snow on old, of yesterday's thaw tightened overnight into ice. Morning of linen spread over glass, of squirrel on the feeder, of a blue jay banking through the white yard, something large and dark in its beak, which it drops under the apple tree and then is gone. Morning of remembering why those breaches in my father's head, the x-rays after the stroke showing rivers at flood stage, meandering and beautiful as Leonardo's studies of Leda before the swan, her hair surging out of tight braids in whirls and eddies, in red pencil and shadow, a deluge of curls obeying its natural laws. Cold morning of new snow, of plane drone and furnace whoosh, of starlings picking apart the suet and the blue jay suddenly among them like an avenger. Morning of such small spaces between snow and ice, wing and air. In his last great studies, Leonardo sketched the heart as a cathedral, its vaults and arches perfect in their calibrations, as if beauty might be a graceful house for the blood, and so calm its turbulence. And I remember a jay last summer, the same one, in the soft maple, pinning a bat in mid-afternoon, holding it down, pecking at the membrane of the wing. Morning of that sound you couldn't expect a bat to make, like electricity forced through a hole. And at my age, my father fathered a child. At my age, he didn't know he had 25 years before the dams would burst, swamping his little town, washing his trees, his horse guard away. Morning of something exploding in a small space, of sliding over the drifts to see what it was the jay let fall, black in the new snow, what it couldn't handle, but there wasn't anything there.
Thank you so much. Okay, let's move on to the second part of the book. There are three parts altogether. And what kind of guy are you? That's a great title for a poem. What kind of guy are you? And then I've got a question for you after you read this poem.
What kind of guy are you? Someone on the phone knew my name. Hi, Keith. Someone was concerned for me. How are you? Is it raining there where you are? The farmers sure need it. Someone's voice with grit in the back of his throat, like a cop or someone pretending to be a cop. We're Vietnam vets trying to help disabled children. You were very generous last year. Can we count on you for $25 or $75 or whatever you think you can spare? And I wasn't thinking, or I was, about the plane crash or the night we went to bed wearing masks or the spindly roses that aren't my fault. And I said no. As I always do, I didn't give you anything last year. I've told you people before, although I wasn't sure if that was the truth, that I'd told him before. It might have been the highway patrol I'd told, or the VFW, or cops, or pretend cops, or disabled children trying to help Vietnam vets. And I thought about the disabled Matisse, chopping nudes from blue paper, how ragged and beautiful they are, disabled in his own image. You don't want to help disabled children? Someone's voice was hiking in the jungle, up some indignant hill, the pack full of draft papers, the pictures of his wife asleep, one bowl to cook in and eat out of. What kind of guy doesn't want to help disabled children? You... And I hung up. I know. I should have had it out with someone like that. But you know me. I'm the kind of guy who sits so quietly that yesterday in the park, a squirrel nearly ran up my leg. I don't stand up even for the national anthem, but I stood up then for the squirrel to save him some embarrassment. And I'm the kind of guy who listens when an old woman with an ugly dog says it's been a long rain, then walks away. The kind of guy with no head for wine, the guy who'd rather be fat than blind, the kind Li Po would tell to bring his loot back in the morning. And I'm the kind of guy who wants to be like my cat Dudley, how every night he claims the pillow at my wife's head, as he has for 15 years, sleeping there, touching her hair, as all my passive, crippled life I've wished I could.
Let's move on to Yellow Landscape. You make quite a leap in this poem. You have a list of trees that you sing for, and then something else happens, so... Why don't you go ahead and read that poem?
Yellow Landscape. I'm walking through goldenrod in new shoes, shoes I got for a song, like the one I'm singing now that pleases the cicadas, the one that would make Schubert cry. And I love the way the ash is the first tree always to turn, throw its hands in the air and say, shoot me, like a tourist on the subway. or the way Napoleon's troops burned the flag rather than surrender it, then drank the ashes in brandy. It didn't matter. They were still the same superior forces. So I'm singing for the ash and the cottonwood, then for the cowardly willow, for crows dying in their steeples, for shirts I never should have thrown out, the ones with destinations on their chests. I'm singing swan songs and torch songs, songs of the Chinese coffin pullers, of men standing on one leg, of the birch outside my window, abducted by bagworms. The tree has wriggled one green leaf free and waves it goodbye like a hanky, waves, "I'm all right, I'll be home, don't worry." And I've got leaves in my pocket for company, and I'm walking through the sunflowers and chicory of the autumnal Midwest, and I'm singing for my occasional friends, two Labradors, who come bounding up, and I'm singing for the kid paid to walk them, but who's always late, singing because I don't like dogs much, but these two include me as if I were still inclusionable. This isn't regret, but relief that again this year we will give up the chateau with a minimum of bloodshed. And the younger dog fetches cottonwood leaves, carries them soft-lipped in his mouth, the way I would if I were a dog, by instinct. And I'm singing because who else but a dog could be so happy at finding me here? And I'm singing because yesterday I needed something to hold, and he laid his gold head in my hands.
Thank you. You know, you make several leaps in this poem. One of them is you have this list of trees, the ash, the cottonwood,
right.
You know, you go on, and then you go to a shirt, to your shirts that you wish you still had. You know, that kind of thing happens throughout the poem. I found myself wondering when I was reading the poem what your relationship is to music other than the music of poetry. Are you a singer? It sounds like you are.
As an undergraduate, I started off as a music major, a vocal music major. The sad part of it was I didn't play the piano. I played the drums.
Hard to sing along to the drums.
It was hard to go into the practice room and accompany yourself with the drums. And I found that I really, really hated to practice. And then I found out that at the end of my freshman year, I was the only vocal major who hadn't gotten an A in voice lessons.
I took
that as a sign.
Yeah. Okay, I won't ask you to sing something. I was considering it, but
I did sing a Schubert song cycle in high school.
Well,
so Schubert is an old friend of mine.
Okay. Well, talking about singing, in the third and last section of this book, you have a poem called Howling Dog, and this refers to a neighbor's dog that sings a country song. He could only sing country or maybe the blues because he's a chained dog.
Right.
Why don't you go ahead and read that?
Howling Dog. This is a poem for Max, my neighbor's husky, howling at snowdrifts at the orange-lit sky. His chest is a squeeze box under the evening spruce, under the moon's white hieroglyph. And I'm howling, too, because I'm a little drunk, because it's cold, because I'm carrying a bucket of parings to the frozen compost pile. Because Max is keening from a low throat churn up three dog octaves and down again. A country song kind of howl. Oh, honey, you done broke my heart. Just bury it in the yard. He's a sweet dog, really. But he's been chained to the garage so long. 4 years, five, dog years beyond counting. He's now unfit for children or the farm. One day he'll make a break for it. And not come back for all the usual car-struck, bulleted, pack-dog reasons. So, he's a good old dog who will never not be chained, governed by the old laws of territory and possession, wall and radius, driveway and food, and misdirected love. My wife has volunteered to walk him, teach him. Emancipation means literally to be led by the hand, which means leash, which means collar he'll have none of. There's no villain here, not Max's first owner who shot himself, not my neighbor who loves Max and everything in the world so much he can't let them go, not Max himself, who imitates the semis that drive him crazy, shifting gears, fourth, fifth, seventh, 11th. Shut the goddamn dog up, someone yells in the dark, until he's calling like a muezzin to the angels, archangels and thrones, virtues, powers, dominations, God's dogs, shackled to God's garage on short chains too, who do what they're told, go and sit, stay and heal, who wait for the biscuit on the nose trick, that humiliation. But God is good, really. We've settled that old issue. He has made us a little lower than the angels, but hears us when we howl. He knows our songs, our equal parts, lying and heartbreak, lawlessness and praise, un- and mild-mannered, tethered and wagging, bad dogs, good dogs that we are.
Before asking you to read one more poem, I noticed that God in one form or another, or prayers or prayer papers, show up quite a bit in your work. I know that you grew up in a Mennonite community.
Right.
Are you a religious person?
I am a religious person, although not a church-going religious person anymore. My little town in Nebraska was made up of three churches, and all three of them were Mennonite. You know, you had the funny schisms that you can only have in religion that are so close that are enough to not make any difference.
Right.
But of course, I have a mixed marriage. I grew up as a General Conference Mennonite, and I married a Mennonite brethren, and that's
I bet that caused some trouble.
It caused some We're still dealing with it after 35 years. So,
it's amazing, huh? Well, why don't you go ahead and read one more poem, The Struggle Between Plenty and Thankfulness, which is where the title of your book came from, Then a Thousand Crows.
Right. The Struggle Between Plenty and Thankfulness. Today, when I framed two crows in the notch of the ash tree, I thought of order. Rain was in the forecast, and presto, rain. Then three crows in the field tilted the world as if imbalance were a blessing, dropped in the cup I keep for blessings. Then four crows in the grass, five on the wire, my plate heaped up with six crows. And to give thanks, to tell God six crows were enough, I lit prayer papers in the garden, their orange slippers, their black, abstract petals like anti-confetti, like hopeful ash, like a thousand crows. Then, a thousand crows.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Catherine.
This has been Keith Ratzliff reading from his book, published by Anhinga Press, Then a Thousand Crows.
I love how you hate the way I always say that you'll learn someday. I love how you keep trying to hold on to me when I turn away. You're painting me pictures of Mrs. and Misters, and they're pictures I'd love to believe. And that's the beautiful thing about princes and queens, and you being so young and naive. You say you're a man and you swear that you can be the world to me. But I've seen the world and I can't be the girl that I think you need. You beg me to listen to see what I'm missing. You're talking all Adam and Eve. And I'm tempted to try, but the problem is I am no longer so young and naive. You look like a face in the movies. Your kiss is straight out of a dream. You treat me like I was a princess. What in the world is the matter with me? Thank you. It's not that I'm jaded, but love's complicated. It's hard to see that at 19. I hear what you're saying about having faith, and you promise me you'll never leave. And I wish I didn't know better, but I'm not so young and naive.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. That was Heather Rigdon singing Young and Naive. She has that song on two different CDs. One is her first CD with the title by the same name, Young and Naive, and she's also included on the Putumayo World Music series, Jazz Around the World. Near the end of 2008, I had the immense pleasure of sitting on the floor of Leslie Scalapino's living room, petting her beautiful white dog while she recorded poems from her latest book at that time, It's Go in Horizontal. I'm very, very sad to say that this fine poet and very kind woman passed away on May 28th of this year in Berkeley, California. I'm going to read a portion of a notice prepared by her family. Leslie Scalapino, 1944 to 2010. Quote, Scalapino makes everything take place in real time, in the light and air and night where all of us live, everything happening at once. Philip Whalen. In childhood, Leslie Scalapino traveled with her father, Robert, founder of UC Berkeley's Institute for Asian Studies, her mother, Dee Scalapino, known for her love of music, and her two sisters, Diane and Lynn, throughout Asia, Africa, and Europe. She and Tom White, her husband, continued these travels, including trips to Tibet, Bhutan, Japan, India, Yemen, Mongolia, Libya, and elsewhere. Her writing was intensely influenced by these travels. She published her first book, O and Other Poems, in 1976, and since then has published 30 books of poetry, prose, intergenre fiction, plays, essays, and collaborations. Scalapino's most recent publications include a collaboration with the artist Kiki Smith, The Animal is in the World Like Water in Water, published by Granary Books, and Floats, Horse Floats, or Horse Flows, published by Star Sharon Books. And her selected poems, It's Go in Horizontal, Selected Poems 1974 to 2006, published by UC Press in 2008. In 1988, her long poem, Way, received the Poetry Center Award, the Lawrence Lipton Prize, and the American Book Award from the Before Columbus Foundation. Her plays have been performed in San Francisco at New Langdon Arts, The Lab, Venue 9, and Forum, in New York by the Eye and Ear Theater, and at Barnard College, and in Los Angeles at Beyond Baroque. In 1986, Scalapino founded O Books as a publishing outlet for young and emerging poets, as well as prominent innovative writers, and the list of nearly 100 titles includes authors such as Ted Berrigan, Robert Grenier, Fanny Howe, Tom Raworth, Norma Cole, Will Alexander, Alice Notley, Norman Fisher, Laura Moriarty, Michael McClure, Judith Goldman, and many others. Scalapino was also the editor of 4 editions of O Anthologies, as well as the periodicals Enough and War and Peace. She taught writing at various institutions, including 16 years in the MFA program at Bard College, Mills College, San Francisco Art Institute, California College of the Arts in San Francisco State University, UC San Diego, and the Naropa Institute. Of her own writing, Scalapino says, "My sense of a practice of writing and of action, the apprehension itself that one is not oneself even for an instant, should not be, is to be participation in is a social act. That is, the nature of this practice that's to be social act is it is without formation or custom." Her writing unbound by a single format, her collaborations with artists and other writers, her teaching and publishing are evidence of this sense of her own practice, social acts that were her practice. Her generosity and fiercely engaged intelligence were everywhere evident to those who had the fortune to know her. Scalapino has 3 books forthcoming in 2010. A book of 2 plays published in 1 volume, Flow-Winged Crocodile and A Pair, Actions Are Erased, Appear, will come out in June 2010 from Chax Press. A new prose work, The Dehedrons, Gazelle Dehedrals, Zoom, will be released this summer by Post Apollo Press. And a revised and expanded collection of her essays and plays, How Phenomena Appear to Unfold, will be published in the fall by Litmus Press. So there you have just a small bit of information about Leslie Scalapino. Right now, I'm going to play part of the recording that she made at the end of 2008, reading from her book, It's a Go in Horizontal. Here now is Leslie Scalapino.
The UC Berkeley Press brought out my selected poems recently, or just brought it out. It's called It's Go in Horizontal, Selected Poems 1974 to 2006. So I thought I'd read several little selections from that, starting with something, a little passage from The Return of Painting, The Pearl and Orion, a trilogy that was written back in, I think it was 1991, it was. And recently I was writing a piece for a Wesleyan anthology about my work, and I had this thought, which I came to looking at the results of my selected and just thinking about it. I realized that I conceive of the senses as being paradise, regardless of whether event or experience is pleasure or pain. I don't conceive of positive events on one side and negative events on the other, like subject or story. But all the senses open and active, the writing in being the location of all of the senses at once would be some kind of state of bliss. And it's also not a notion of the individual either being or seeking wholeness, as if that's some kind of idea that's a social fabrication. Anyway, this is from, also in The Return of Painting, The Pearl and Orion, I have the notion of a text that you could kind of bask in that would also be always being in a present time, and the lines of the text being as if paragraphs or single lines like a scroll unfolding, and that one would be in the present time of each line, that would be each paragraph. So this is a passage from it. Woman waiting on long yellow grass. There's the blue sky. She's waiting, turmoil, and some buzzards are on the grass. That is before her. Slow, low gutting on the long yellow grass. And the buzzards are on the corpse that is amidst the grass. Hams forward and then back, waiting. And ahead and behind that in the grass. In the blue sky, on the slope, hams extended forward, waiting, on it, rolled down the grass, and the buzzards on one, cluster flapping, that is in the blue sky, cluster flapping on a corpse, waiting on, indentation in the wave of slopes and buzzards, starter on a corpse flapping, up, hams waiting up, in it. The buzzards in it had been on the corpses here and there, flapping cluster in it on one, the whir in that, the mixing amidst it in the indentation, pushed into going into the ocean, which is at the edge of this, on the rise, with the others who are churning. The water is heavy, the rise of it, the living have struggled into it. A shot cracks into it, and a corpse boils. The living churning around it, the lighted sea. The other feels a crack in her side, the hip that is soaked, hanging in the heavy water. Blood that comes into the sea from the humans. And wading in who are shooting, they keep on going, cracks of shots in it. Turning, heavy mass, swimming, the rolls in the waves. Having the hip that had hung in the water, in the long grass. Weeds entwined, dragging the hip leg line. Slept deeply before, the man on the mounted pickup truck emerges through grass, a shot in the heavy grass, the leg lying twined in the weed and rolling into indentation. Buzzards fly up from a corpse in the indentation flapping on it, which is turned over on its trunk, trunk of woman low wading now. Her on the long grass, rolling into indentation of reddish cattle with gentle white faces who are kneeling in it, the kneeling gentle cattle beginning to stand, frightened. The leg is soaked, the kneeling cattle standing, settling, the twined grass in among them, slept in a matted indentation with them, the men out of the mounted pickup truck overseeing, muffled. Lying by the steer, it is not devil. There's a puff, crack of shots, muffled. Morning comes. It does not come. How can it? The thick, slurred cattle kneeling, eating in the light air. The lightened, white air. Wheeling oneself forward on a cart. A sled of the leg. On the sidewalk, asking money of the passers-by. In it, on the sled, it is free. For the one, they think, for that other who's asking for the money. On the sled, it is. A soldier, affected by the unburied dead, covered with the buzzards in the valleys, and not turn that inward. And then he's in the light air, and not figure out how it unfolds. Wheeling on the sled, having slept in the indentation, deer simply have ticks which become huge until they drop off. A huge tick in the side of having waited. They began singing. Soldiers she meets on the road or a choir, and they begin singing. Into the area of just pulp, only that. One realizing I have to do this myself. The leg is soaked. She goes on the sled. There's a sandbar. Out along, stretching on which are corpses, the buzzards had encrusting flapping, the light air is coming up, no planet or orb, an orb floating, now it's gone. And out tangled in the yellow grass, on it, the woman waiting, there's a corpse in the grass, the buzzards sapping it, whirling, it's far gone, in the light air, it can't be that in the long yellow grass. The hams stretch out and running down the slope in the yellow grass, arms twirling, flapping, being in the grass. There are weeds. It's dawn. Encounter sensitive man, as in trunk of seal, lying on her rearing. They're coming. The light air is coming up. Entwined thrashing around, he puts it into her again, him rearing, on the trunk. He withdraws it, takes it out. The weeds are still. He puts it back in, on the trunk. The trunk, the bulb of it in her after, the dawn. There was this crescent moon hanging with a bright planet in this bright blue night sky. They were low in it. The sack of corpse wavered bulb that was created by some behavior. They, the orbs, weren't held. Birds come glancing, sucked and then released by the one or the people in their behavior. It's completely irrelevant. The market creating the jewel, and be that completely. What is bothering you that you had to be on the street? I had 5 children. Why be in the comic book? We simply are in it, yet we must try to be in it. I don't know how. Girl is seen walking on the street, black on the bright, billowing sky. She comes up to the other and then is on the other side with the puffed, illumined sky before the other. Reading memory only is REM. Some homeless people are by the Safeway where they congregate, opening tins someone has given them. As she goes outdoor and by them towards billowing sky, they're sitting holding the tins, the sky appearing to move. These guys who attack her in the sense of bullying don't do that to the individual. It's to someone, the instigating bully, as a way of flattering them so that they go along with him in order to have that. It is not friendship with him or to them. It's flattery which he reflects back to himself. And seeing this, supposing one sees it, it will not do anything. They see that, or don't, and it isn't there. They're not interpreting it that way. Then seeing it on the retina is reading memory only. As there is no relation to exteriority, the women emerging into the Safeway who might have beaten the boy at that age, there was no commentary coming to them. There is not that coming from them then, the men opening the tins. There is no commentary. Who cares, from or to them? It's invisible to them who interpret this, but if one sees that it is that, it is not so. And so this has to be serial, with it being in front. Desperation is serial, so can't be seen by them. And so it has to be inexperience that is in front. As the comic book is invisible to them, for it is inside, they can be in it. So that's from The Return of Painting, The Pearl and Orion, actually from the last section. And I was interested in the notion of a comic book, and that's what I meant by single lines making a present time that one would continuously be in as the reader. This is from, continuing to read from my selected. It's from New Time. And I imagined this as a rim, spelled R-I-M, that's a way of concentrating and being attentive also to the present time, making a seeing of material and thoughts and whatever one's in, as being just a rim that's like a line of horizon that one concentrates on, and everything comes up to that and moves away from it at the same time. There's no time to oneself. Is the dawn occurring? It's rim. It has no rim. Pressure, so that the mind comes into the social unit. It isn't done by people. There's no time to oneself. It's done by people only. The night, the dawn there. The constructed unit being no time to oneself, standing, being completely alone, standing as walking. Flowering trees float the sky, packed luminous sky of ocean, a sky that is an ocean. The group, not having time for oneself, opens that one floated sky. Sleep deprived one, pressure so that the mind comes into the social unit only. The flowering trees that have nothing but swimming on sky. We cannot speak as to concentrate on the constructed unit, nor sleep much, and that causes an actual harmony. Serial, or it's there after a while, not based on the similarities of the people. The night is exhaustion, rains, luminous night while running to the rise. That's dawn is when running to the rise. Later, the rise is the floating people. They're going into houses, killing. Is the fact. The fact is delicate, in existence even. People love patricians. Form is exhausting. One has to exist there. The physical body has no brown night. If the nature of this is struggling wall of birds flying that aren't on their own, if we're not going to do this with people, there isn't any existence. I'm relieved by the wall of birds. One is, in fact, struggling and not with one's, their existence. It is a fact. This is a light relief. rain through huge red leaves, sea above and below, sea floor and sky, freezing night, though leaves sea is at day, rain, man's lying, breathing beside one is enhanced from, and it being in night, night itself, not from freezing night. Night can not be enhanced from the man's soft breathing, which is beside one, as rain in it, day, which is the vast red leaves sea, isn't by the one's horizontal lying breathing, rain lying, pouring sheets, one is by someone as not enhancing rain, only breathing, running together on the rise, is horizontal lying at night. Physical strength in leaping, hanging, falling, which is sometimes on each other, so that hanging they are floating as swaying by each other in the air, reflected as if they were walking on the ground, whereas they're physically beating their own bodies on a wall that is there. The social unit only, as it's in one's frame and flesh. People sprawled leaning on wall of subway underground, in passing it. They can't rest, can in subway underground, but not at all, they aren't resting. They have to run as was to the rise, that is their motions. People sprawled, leaning on walls, resting, are finding or have to find a way to do it. The mind is action literally, not departing from that, being events or movement outside, which is inside. So the mind is collapsing into and as action. I can't rest at all now. This is despair. Poor Dante, if action of events, my mind, were the same as resting, brought to that, in the way the physical body rests outside, one is not having a rim. Understanding, rather than just get rid of one's mind and body in traveling at all, the physical body, inner, must continue to move. Only the day, only no night, which is delicate, is walking in the street once with someone shopping for a dinner with others. The sole event of that is for nothing pressed up to the thin day ahead of one being in this present at the same time. The events, a rim collapsing in one, differing times on the same present, and one's no, but one fears that's too fast. The two events are only spring obstructions, as one won't be in be them at the present at the same time, being no, but. Cold, freezing red sky dusk, slice, reduction not existing, walking only as clear one outside, dark roses are in it, as freezing reds slice, a half of the night scene, which isn't there yet, sky only is there at all, bright dark roses, not bud ever. In the slice only?
Beat. The beat moves on, right into life, after life, before birth can flash, lightning and turquoise, the dream collapses into the river. While the current flows, the boat sets off. Long regret. This body, no possession of mine. The vigor is pulses of delusion, leaning outward from damp lips mirroring in the wake. Before meat conceived of its hunger, I was inside the stream, listening to myself out there, barging and crashing in a fantasy of bombs and gases and children being raped in prisons and silver tinsel on Christmas trees. How precious is this pearl of exploded harmony, reflecting the feet of nothingness, drumming on packed earth. Let me work with these monster dragons. I will see clearly and be generous. I'm plush green moss, bubbling with anger, and the beat moves on into life after life. I am trying to flash, but the best I can manage is my love for you.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. That was the great beat poet Michael McClure performing Beat Goes On with Ray Manzarek. Before that, you heard the late Leslie Scalapino reading from her book, It's Go in Horizontal. My first guest of the evening was Keith Ratzliff. He is the author of Then a Thousand Crows, published by Anhinga Press. And that is a wrap. So thank you very much for listening. If you have any questions or comments about tonight's show, you can contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. And if you'd like information about future radio programs coming up here on KRCB, or about the live Word Temple Poetry Series that takes place at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts, you can go to wordtemple.com. Now, it's only July, but I know how quickly all our calendars get filled up, so I want to tell you about a couple of events coming up in September of this year. First, on September 19th from 11 a.m. to 8 p.m., the Petaluma Poetry Walk will be back at various venues in Petaluma. The first one is at the Petaluma Art Center at 11 o'clock and is hosted by Terry Arrett. And then on September 25th, from 10 to 4, the Sonoma County Book Festival returns. This is presented by the Literary Arts Guild and takes place in Courthouse Square. This also is a free event. That's September 25th from 10 to 4. And that, my dears, is it. Thanks for listening.